Welcome to the Occupational Health Special Interest Group podcast. I'm your host, Chris Studebaker. The mission of the Occupational Health Special Interest Group podcast is to present important concepts and ideas in the world of occupational health to our listeners. On this podcast, we bring experts from the field of occupational health to share their unique perspective about topics such as worker injury management, workplace wellness and prevention, pre-employment testing, ergonomics, and functional capacity evaluations. If you have not had the chance to listen to some of our other guest interviews and literature review podcasts, please go to the OSIG section of the Orthopedics section's website, www.orthopt.org. There you can find all of the archived podcasts plus other helpful resources. Now let's get started. This episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Julie Fritz, Professor of Physical Therapy at the University of Utah's College of Health, an adjunct professor of orthopedic surgery at the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Utah. Dr. Fritz, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure.
In your long and distinguished career, you've done an enormous amount of research in the field of orthopedics on topics ranging from low back pain and spinal manipulation to the development of clinical prediction rules for low back and neck pain, to the impact of fear avoidance beliefs on injuries. Our listeners are particularly interested in research that helps them to assess and treat the injured worker. Now, you've published articles on a lot of different topics, but much of your research is focused on the spine. Whether it be clinical prediction rules to the use of therapy over imaging, you've covered a great many topics in the area of managing low back pain in particular. It seems that both the healthcare community and the media are really starting to take notice of the shortcomings of a lot of traditional treatments and imaging that have historically been used to manage low back pain. Specifically, there's been a lot of scrutiny on the use of injections and surgery, MRIs, and especially opioids of late for the management of low back pain. Despite the evidence that supports the use of physical therapy in the management of low back pain, there are still a lot of patients that do not receive therapy for this condition. Do you feel that the physical therapy profession is doing a good enough job trying to establish itself as the preferred method for managing low back pain?
Well, I think I'd reframe that a little bit. Back pain, of course, is extremely complex and inherently multivariate. So the idea that there's any one provider type who is preferred for all back pain is not really a realistic or very patient-centered goal for back pain management. So as I look at it, I see the physical therapy profession working to establish its value in the care that's provided to back pain and to better articulate what physical therapists can provide and when in the timing of care it's most beneficial for physical therapy to be involved. And I do think that we collectively as a profession are advancing and learning how to both research those questions and to engage in dialogue professionally about the value of physical therapy and where that role is best played. Most importantly, and maybe the area where the most work is yet to be done is the patient population and their perspective on when a physical therapist ought to come to their mind as the provider who makes the most sense for them, given a certain type of back pain.
So where can we go from here, do you think, as a profession, to sort of expand our position in the healthcare industry to kind of become that go-to choice, not only for managing low back pain, but also musculoskeletal disorders in general, sort of in the mind of the patient?
Well, I'm sure most people listening, like myself, that when these conversations come up in my healthcare system and in my university, the context within which a compelling case can be made for the role of physical therapy is all around the value equation. And that really puts the impetus on us to provide the outcomes data that matters to patients and consider that relative to the cost of the care that we provide. And that becomes the factor that is persuasive to many of our colleagues. And And by and large, just like a lot of medical providers, we're not able to provide quantitative information that covers both ends of that equation, both the numerator and the denominator. And without that, it becomes more and more difficult to advocate for what's often a change in the way care is delivered, repositioning physical therapy. And without an argument that comes from a perspective of value, those conversations, in my experience, generally don't go very far.
Gotcha. Another area that you've researched is use of clinical prediction rules. You know, I remember 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't swing a stick in the profession without hitting 5 or 10 clinical prediction rules in any direction, but they seem to have kind of been on the decline of late and have lost favor. How would you describe the current state of research and support for the use of clinical prediction rules in orthopedics?
Well, you know, it's been an interesting sort of journey, if you will, and historically with that whole line of research. And really, in my mind, and in the medical literature about decision making, the idea that any rule would stand on its own as the beginning and the end of a decision making process is not the intent. So there's a lot of different factors, as any clinician knows, that factor into making a clinical decision, and bringing evidence to bear from clinical research on how decisions are made is where something like a prediction rule can be informative and influential. But I agree with you that for a period of time, they sort of took on a life of their own. And I think the role of evidence related to the outcomes that we can expect from patients who exhibit various characteristics and the ability to put that information together kind of got lost in somewhere in the midst of that time period relative to other factors making clinical decisions. And so I think at least in some ways, the expectations around what that data was that what went into clinical prediction rules was ever supposed to be for, we kind of lost sight of that. And so the question about the state of clinical prediction rules, I would expand to say that really this has been an iterative process of developing ideas about how we use patient-level information to make clinical decisions, and how do we integrate that into an overall clinical decision-making process. And I think most people would agree to me there's a lot of work to be done in that arena, and to, on the one hand, to oversimplify it and think that those decisions could be driven by strictly a couple of patient factors was never very realistic. And on the flip side, abandoning the sense that there's any kind of data that can be useful for clinical decision making is equally erroneous, kind of on the other side of that. So, you know, hopefully we're continuing a process of understanding how to bring an evidence-based perspective to clinical decision making and integrate in the patient experience with the clinician, along with data that we have from other clinical research studies and different ways of looking at it.
Gotcha. So in essence, you're saying, you know, it was meant to be a guide to offer kind of direction based on patient level factors, but it was sort of adopted as a be-all, end-all recipe for how patients were being treated, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Yeah, I think part of the lesson learned from that sort of historical moment was that this conversation about how to integrate evidence into clinical decision making is a difficult one. And on the one hand, that doesn't mean to abandon the process of trying to figure out how to do this. On the other hand, it's not simple. I think as I look back on where we were starting from in even taking that approach in physical therapy and with some of the treatments that we use, at the time, there was very little efforts to integrate clinical evidence into the decision-making process. And I think historically, at least as I look at it, the contribution of some of those studies was to shift the conversation to a point of thinking about how can we research the decision-making process and combine it with the more qualitative aspects of the decision-making process to really help clinicians make better decisions. And that's clearly a work in progress.
Sure. It's interesting that you bring up that historical perspective where, you know, I'm not a young man by any means, but there's certainly listeners out there who really have gone to school and have only practiced in the modern era of evidence-based practice. But there's a lot of our listeners out there who can remember, you know, a time before that emphasis was placed in the profession where, you know, we were certainly in a sorely lacking in more of an emphasis on actually applying evidence to what we did.
So yeah.
That's an important thing to remember.
And I guess I'm old enough now to have a historical perspective, which is a little disconcerting. But, yeah, I agree. I think back on the conversations that we had at professional meetings in the time prior to that and what we were arguing about versus what we're debating now. And there's a progress there that's not certainly only attributable to those particular studies, but there was a step that needed to be taken, at least in my perspective, looking back on that began to think about how to leverage data to make decisions. And we talk about that in a very different way now, and have advanced in certain ways in that conversation.
Where do you see the profession going forward with the use, I guess, not only of clinical prediction rules, but also trying to take that next step in emphasizing evidence-based practice into clinical care? What do you think is on the horizon in the future as far as research or other factors?
Well, there's certainly a whole host of things. But, you know, I think what we have the opportunity to do now and we have to leverage better is the large amounts of data that we collect on patients and to really strategize how to use that information in real time to help make better decisions with patients and oftentimes actually engage the patient in that process of decision making. So our healthcare system, like most, collects troves of patient level information that we can learn from and become what's often called a learning health system and be able to provide real-time information to therapists, to providers, and to patients about what we've learned about patients like them from previous experience and what kind of options are likely to result in which kind of outcomes. And we haven't had that capability before just because of the electronic resources that are required to do that kind of work, but we do now. And I think there's a lot of potential within physical therapy to better leverage that information and to think about interesting ways to engage the patient in the process of learning from that information.
That's probably an interesting segue into my next question, which is, you know, more the patient side of physical therapy. A lot has been discussed about the concepts of fear avoidance behavior and central sensitization as it relates to the perception of pain, which can apply to all populations, but you know, specifically to our listeners, you know, where they might pertain to the management of injured workers. How have these two concepts changed the way the physical therapy profession looks at the management of musculoskeletal disorders?
Well, it's not unique to physical therapy, but particularly fear avoidance beliefs, I would say, is representative of our growing understanding about the important role of psychosocial factors in the pain experience. And again, I think you and I are probably old enough to remember when the idea of a biopsychosocial approach to pain was a bit of a revolution because we had this very pathoanatomical sort of perspective about what pain was and that it directly related to tissue damage, and it was a very biomedical perspective. And the fear avoidance model really helped, I think, for those of us in physical therapy because it relates so well to the patients we see, to understand that the cognitive responses of patients to the pain experience are overwhelming in importance relative to physical structural changes that may happen as a result of some kind of injury. And that's really revolutionize the way we look at patients with pain. We still have a lot of the legacy to overcome of that very biomedical perspective, that our language and our a lot of our decisions still really harken back to that model. But I think at this point in time, none of us can any longer deny the impact of the psychological, emotional responses to pain and how overwhelmingly important they are.
Do you feel that the physical therapy profession does a better job of identifying and taking into consideration that psychosocial or psychosocial factors in patients than a lot of other healthcare providers?
Well, you know, I'm sure, I don't know that I'd want to characterize an entire profession relative to another, but I do think we have advantages because of what we do and how we interact with patients in embracing a biopsychosocial model and really using it to our advantage, because we spend so much more time with patients. And really, even when I think back before the biopsychosocial model was sort of the norm, the people I think of that I came across who were really good therapists were really good therapists because they knew how to relate to patients, and they wouldn't have known anything about fear avoidance beliefs or the fear avoidance model or any of this. But they understood this aspect of a patient's pain experience in a way that helped them to relate to the patient and helped them overcome psychological barriers to recovery. So I think there's a legacy because of the way we relate to patients that that what was a real revolution in pain management and other professions was a little bit less of a complete sea change for us in physical therapy, because we sort of did some of this, at least really good therapists did, even without almost knowing it.
Yeah, it was just did intuitively, but didn't have fancy terms for it. Do you think that entry-level DPT programs are providing enough education on these concepts to kind of steer us away from that biomedical model going forward?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more work that we all can do. I know in our own program, this is something that we're continually evaluating, both in our educational, you know, classroom didactic component, but also in the clinical experiences that that our trainees have in physical therapy clinics. And a lot of it is what seems like subtle language issues and the way we describe patients' conditions, the way we describe things to patients, that have this legacy of the biomedical model that is I think at times for patients a barrier. So, you know, the most obvious one is people who come, students who come back from the clinic and talk to me about learning or patients that they saw on their seat with their CI who their SI was out of place and they put it back in place, and this very kind of structural language that goes back to a model that's not really very helpful. It's not really very current with the evidence. And it can be problematic to patients who have some psychological considerations that may fixate on that kind of language, and it creates barriers to recovery. So it still is an ongoing work to make the connection to realizing that how we explain what we're doing with patients is really critical, that we don't contribute to psychological barriers to recovery.
Yeah, and, you know, with there being such a high percentage of work-related musculoskeletal injuries that have, a considerable amount of psychosocial impact, you know, I think getting away from the language of I fix you and getting more towards the language of we will work together to, you know, to improve your condition, you know, is especially important in the worker population, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, I can appreciate that is particularly critical in the population of occupational injury, you know, as well as musculoskeletal injury in general. And that's a really nice way of succinctly stating the change or the problem that sometimes we see arise, that it's that language of I'm doing something to you versus I'm helping you to achieve something and we're doing it together.
Yeah, kind of piggybacks with the use of active treatment, you know, instead of passive modalities and, you know, hot techs and things of that nature. So
yeah, it's an active language, if you want to put it that way, instead of passive language. And, you know, as we start to understand the importance of things like the patient's motivation and self-efficacy, that I'll fix you kind of passive language can be particularly problematic for someone who lacks the confidence to sort of self-manage their own condition. And it feeds into that problematic relationship of searching for the provider who's going to fix you, particularly in more chronic and recurrent kind of situations.
That whole concept of the therapeutic alliance is, mm-hmm. you know, is one that I've been myself paying a lot more attention to. And, you know, when you read it on paper, it's like, yeah, duh, that makes sense. Of course you want to build an alliance. But, you know, in practice, it's very easy to have kind of patriarchal approach to treating your patients, at least when, you know, you've been in the profession for a long time and you're kind of raised in that mechanical model, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's something, and this is not unique to physical therapy either, but I agree with you. It's easy and it's there's some part of us as clinicians that we do want to help people and we'd love to be able to just fix people. And it's easy to fall into that sort of dynamic with a patient because there are a fair number of patients who would be thrilled. They're also in that mindset and they're looking to you to do that. And it's up to us as professionals to recognize that that's not a therapeutic kind of alliance between the patient and provider. When we fall into those roles, it's not likely going to lead to a very good outcome.
I agree. Finally, Dr. Prince, one last question. You know, somebody with your position and stature in the profession is curious to know, what unique opportunities and challenges do you see for us as a profession going forward? Where do you think PT will be in 10 years? What will we look like in the world of healthcare, you know, in a decade from now?
Yeah. Well, I think there's I'm very optimistic. I think there's tremendous opportunity because the healthcare environment is looking for more and innovative ways to improve value. And I think there are many ways that we as physical therapists can demonstrate a value-added proposition in a lot of healthcare processes. And if we think innovatively about how to deliver care, and don't lock ourselves into old models and certain ways of thinking, there could be tremendous potential to play very different sorts of roles in the area of prevention, both primary prevention and secondary prevention, that we're not playing to the extent that we could in the current delivery model. But it's, you know, it's going to take some data and some demonstration of this value proposition. And two, it's going to take creativity and innovation for us as a profession to not think that physical therapy always has to look like the way we're used to delivering it. And whether that, what exactly that means, we'll see in 10 years from now, but I doubt will be that the practice settings that our students emerge into will look exactly the same as they do now.
Well, Dr. Fritz, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I know I can say for our listeners and for me personally, your work has been incredibly important for orthopedic clinical practice, and I appreciate everything that you've done. We hope you come back on the podcast sometime, and you know, who knows, maybe in 10 years we'll get to see and have you back and see if you were right or not.
I don't know. That'd be great, though. Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed it.
To all our listeners, thanks for tuning in. If you've not done so already, be sure to check us out on Facebook or on the Orthopedic Section's website. Be sure to tune in to our next podcast, which will be next quarter. So long.